From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn arrested, accused of financial misconduct, shocking the auto world.
If I was to rank it on a scale of 1 to 10, I think it's much, much closer to 10.
Michigan students work with students from the Middle East and North Africa to problem solve and build bridges.
There are like some small differences in culture, like mannerisms and things like that, but overall I realized how similar really we were.
And John Eubacon previews the Michigan-Ohio State game.
But Ohio State, no one on that team has ever lost to Michigan. They don't know what it's like. Whereas Michigan, man, they know that all their chips are in. They're playing for everything, including potentially a national title.
Plus, a high school student goes to bat for sleep-deprived teens. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The auto world is stunned today with news that Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn has been arrested in Japan for financial misconduct. He's the architect of the three-way union of Renault, Nissan, and Mitsubishi. Leisha Santarelli is covering this story for the BBC, and she's here with us now. As someone who follows the global auto industry, Leisha, how surprising is this news?
Well, Cynthia, if I was to rank it on a scale of 1 to 10, I think it's much, much closer to 10. Everyone was taken aback by Mr. Ghosn's arrest, and I think this was reflected in the share markets, where we saw Renault, which was trading at the time when the news came out, plunge by as much as 15%. Mitsubishi and Nissan are listed in Tokyo, and so we can expect some pretty strong reaction when the market reopens there on Tuesday. But based off the American depository receipts for Nissan, it looks like it's going to be a day of heavy selling. So everyone's really taken aback, investors included.
Exactly what is Ghosn accused of doing?
Well, the allegations involve Mr. Ghosn underreporting his salary. The local media outlets in the country, they are called Kyoto and Jiji, say that, for example, on a salary of 10 billion yen, he reported that at around nearly 5 billion yen. So to put that in US dollars, his salary was close to $89 million, and he reported it at nearly half that. So that's one allegation. Another involves the personal use of company assets, and according to Nissan, significant acts of financial misconduct. And they didn't go into further detail as to what these significant acts were, but they're taking it very seriously.
And there was another top executive, an American, arrested with him, correct?
That's right. All the attention has focused on Mr. Ghosn for now, but Greg Kelly is a 62-year-old executive. He rose through the ranks. He started out in human resources, but according to Nissan, he was deeply involved in these acts of financial misconduct. What we know of Mr. Kelly, according to trade publications, is that he was the first American board member at Nissan. There are four non-Japanese on Nissan's nine-person board.
So do we have any idea yet how long this has allegedly been going on? What is Nissan saying?
Nissan says that this misconduct has been going on for a number of years, but they didn't really give much detail beyond that because these remain allegations, and in Japan, an arrest also does not mean that Mr. Ghosn is guilty. And so we'd have to go through the judicial process to see more facts emerge.
Leisha, how did this come to light?
Well, this actually came to light through an internal whistleblower. So this is something that is quite unique to Japan in recent years. We've had major companies come out to the public reporting financial misconduct or accounting irregularities after an internal investigation took place in the company due to a whistleblowing report. Obviously, the person has remained unidentified, but the scale of the scandal is similar to what we saw, for example, at Toshiba in 2015, when back then, at this giant Japanese company, a whistleblower uncovered Toshiba had been inflating profits for many years.
It has to make you wonder about the accuracy of auditing at Nissan, since they are saying that this has happened over many years.
Absolutely. With previous scandals at Toshiba, which I just mentioned, as well as at a camera maker called Olympus, there have been scandals in corporate Japan which have led to questions about the corporate governance as well as the accountability at these big companies as to how they could allow such financial misconduct or wrongdoing to continue for so many years without being spotted. But it does also show that corporate governance is very important to the Japanese because they've come forward and accused one of the most powerful men in the car industry of misconduct, basically, based off this whistleblower report and an investigation that they said took several months.
Now, just thinking of what accomplishments Carlos Ghosn is most known of, I know here in Michigan, many folks may remember he pushed very hard for a three-way alliance among General Motors, Renault, and Nissan, but that did not come together. But what were some of his other top accomplishments through his very, very prominent career?
Carlos Ghosn was the man who saved Nissan, an iconic Japanese company, from collapse. He turned its fortunes around and he brought it into the auto industry's biggest partnership, which you mentioned. Over the course of 20 years, he has basically proven himself to be a very, very efficient boss. He was nicknamed at the company Le Cost Killer because of his ruthless management style. Because of his success at turning Nissan around and bringing together these disparate car makers into this alliance, he gained a real cult following, particularly in Japan. He even had, for example, a manga, a Japanese comic written about his life. Japanese businessmen used to buy rice sculptures that were done like his face for their lunchboxes. So Mr. Ghosn really was very popular among the business community. And in recent years, the only questions around his leadership has been around succession. Who is going to take over from Mr. Ghosn in running the alliance and taking it into the next chapter? Because the auto industry is facing massive upheaval at the moment with the move towards electric and autonomous cars, as well as the impact of the US-China trade war on the industry. And so that was really what people were wondering, what was going to happen and whether anyone could really fill these very big shoes. But now with this scandal, it's really anyone's guess. But most analysts that you speak to would say that it would be very hard for a single person to really replicate what Mr. Ghosn has achieved.
When you stop and realize these three companies, when you between Renault, Nissan, and Mitsubishi, employ more than 470,000 people in what, some nearly 200 countries. This is really something that could have global impact.
Absolutely. So with the alliance, aside from the questions of succession, there are now questions around its survival. One of the big reasons why these car makers came together and consolidated was because back then, Mr. Ghosn championed creating cheap cars for the masses in emerging markets. He was also an early proponent of electric vehicles, and he believed that there were too many car makers in the world and that the way forward was through consolidation. And so through this alliance, he helped turn ailing fortunes around through economies of scale. So it essentially became cheaper to manufacture cars because all of these three companies were combining their resources rather than having to do it on their own. Now, as to what happens next, well, some people wonder whether without Mr. Ghosn at the helm and with him being arrested, whether this alliance is going to splinter apart and whether they can survive if they break apart. But what we do know is that Nissan's new chief executive, Hiroto Saikawa, is very much against Renault and Nissan merging, even though today at a press conference he said that the alliance would go on. Analysts are questioning whether it really will. Now, this alliance is very important because it creates one out of every nine cars that were made last year. This alliance basically allows consumers to buy cars for cheaper, especially at such a turbulent time for the industry. And so, like everyone else, everyone's watching to see what will happen next for Mr. Ghosn and what they end up deciding to do with the alliance, whether to keep it together, who will replace him at the head if so, or whether it's going to break apart.
Reporting on today's arrest in Japan of Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn, we've been talking with Leisha Santarelli with the BBC. Leisha, thank you so much.
It was great speaking to you.
This week on Michigan Radio's Believed, it's the beginning of the end for Larry Nassar. Soon, he'll go from being known as a beloved Olympic sports doctor to one of the worst serial sexual abusers in sports history. There are three things that set off Nassar's fall in the summer of 2016. A detective on the Michigan State University police force, a team of journalists in Indiana, and a homeschooling mom in Kentucky. Reporter Lindsay Smith picks it up from here in Believed, Episode 5, How He Got Caught.
Your spoon, because that's what you'll get to taste.
That mom is Rachel Denhollander. She's also a lawyer, a devout Christian, and a self-described homemade chocolate frosting addict.
And everybody will get something like that, I promise.
All three of Rachel's kids, Jonathan, Annalise, and Eliana, get a plastic baby spoon to taste test. They're crowded around the kitchen table at home in Louisville, Kentucky.
I've made cakes with my two girls. I envy Rachel's patience.
If you've seen coverage of the Larry Nassar case, Rachel's face is probably a familiar one.
She's got brown hair down to her waist, the long, slim build of a ballet dancer, even though we are visiting her when she is very pregnant with her fourth child. Last time Rachel was pregnant, she stocked the deep freezer with enough meals for a year. What I'm saying is this woman knows how to prepare. You will see that come in handy later.
Rachel's husband is Jacob Denhollander. His Twitter profile lists him as president of Rachel's fan club and a Christian. He's also a long-suffering Calgary Flames hockey fan and a PhD student in theology.
He's always, pretty much always, the first one to say I'm sorry when we've been crabby with each other. It's true. Yeah, there are a lot of things.
But let's also keep in mind here, what would happen and what does happen when I try to argue?
I win.
I always say you're never going to win an argument with an attorney, and you're never going to win an argument with your wife. So I'm in doubly disadvantaged. But that's one of the things I actually really appreciate about Rachel is that she uses her powers for good.
Jacob has seen Rachel for years now, using her powers for good. Back in the summer of 2016, Rachel's in this very same kitchen when an article on Facebook catches her eye.
I don't think I will ever forget seeing the article come through.
It's this big investigation in the Indianapolis Star. It says USA Gymnastics has been covering up complaints of sexual abuse against coaches. Coaches who were able to move from gym to gym abusing kids.
Good morning. The paper is reporting that on multiple occasions, USA Gymnastics compiled complaints of coaches accused of sexual misconduct.
Warnings of suspected misconduct by member coaches were ignored.
Files on more than 50 coaches around the country. Claims that had long sat in drawers at its office in Indianapolis.
You can find all of Believed at Bleeb's episodes and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Monday. Coming up this Thanksgiving, the teens in your life might be thankful for a break from their packed schedules and all that homework.
This chronic overbooking is leading teens to really not have enough time for everything in their lives. And what gets prioritized is not sleep.
Why your teen needs a healthy dose of Z's. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Cybersecurity experts are warning that medical devices like pacemakers could be taken advantage of by hackers. Indeed, the federal government's looking closely at how to protect these devices. It's the latest warning of many as technology makes its way into virtually every corner of our lives. University of Michigan electrical engineering and computer science professor H.V. Jagadish wants his students to be more aware of the social impact they're having, aware of the ethics as companies work with important private information. Professor Jagadish, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So you recently launched an online class at the university on ethical data science. What is that? What does that look like?
As you mentioned, data science is having a great deal of impact on society, and this impact, it's important to understand. Technologists tend to try to solve problems that are within a limited domain of the technology that they have expertise in, and all too often, the students that we train say, well, we know how to write a computer algorithm, how to solve this problem on a computer, how to make it go fast, how to make it more efficient, more correct, etc. But that's where they stop. And given that many of the things that we do are having such a great impact on society, I think that it's important that we think about that. My purpose in devising this course was to say, yes, ethics is something that as a subject of expertise, perhaps philosophers are the ones that might think the most about these issues and so on. But as technologists, we need to at least have some understanding of what our technology is doing, what kind of impact it's having on society, and The purpose of this course is to try to get technologists to have some initial basic understanding, a basic framework to reason through issues.
And also, don't companies need to stop and think about, you know, this is private information, this is personal information, and the public doesn't always know what's going to happen with it when you fill out the form online and send that in. And by golly, maybe it's being sold elsewhere. And we have no idea as the consuming public, do we?
In the U.S., we don't, because we don't have laws that limit what companies can do. By and large, there is a long license agreement, a privacy agreement that nobody reads and everybody clicks through. And I think that that's not a great state of affairs. In many other countries, governments are trying to be more aggressive about this. Recently in Europe, they instituted something called GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation. And since the European market is a significant market for many technology companies, once they build in protections that meet the European rules, these things end up benefiting people the world over, even in the absence of regulation that compels them to do so.
Professor, I want to ask you about a term that I've heard more and more lately, ethical hacking or white hat hacking, which is essentially breaking into software before it happens to warn a company or a organization about what a bad person is able to do. We've seen stories about auto companies looking for these kinds of white hat hacking employees. Is ethical hacking becoming some new kind of industry?
I think that security for any system is trying to build defenses against what attackers might do. Just as if you're building a physical facility, you might want to set up challenges for somebody to come in, try to break in and figure out what the weak spots are. One would try to do that in the computing system world as well. I think that this notion of white hat hacking has actually been around for a long time. Companies understand that software might have bugs and they want these bugs found. They want to patch them. And most software companies will offer a bounty for people who find problems with their software and report it to the company so that they can get to it before some bad person does.
It certainly seems as if you're issuing a challenge for businesses to self-examine. And also, I guess there's a challenge for educators as well in all of this.
Yes, I think that this is an important issue for us to study. So at the University of Michigan, we are setting up a center for the study of information systems impacting society. Specifically, it is technical information systems focus, with the goal being to understand their impact on society and manage their impact on society. People having some understanding of the issues from an educational perspective is a goal that we are trying to meet. But I think that there are harder questions that we may not know the answers to and that require further study and research. I think companies are beginning to think about this more and more. There is certainly a need for greater awareness, but it's getting there. I'm optimistic. I think that we will do well.
So when you say there's more that can be done, where would that go? Where do you see that going?
For example, one of the things that we have got some new results in is an issue of how one can develop algorithms that can produce outputs that are more diverse and fair. So consider an admissions office, and let's say that it's got some criteria in terms of GPAs and test scores and so on. And let's suppose that it's got some weighting function, some formula for how many points for each of these, and you can add it up and come up with some value. An admissions officer would make up some rules for what make reasonable weights based on their experience and knowledge. And changing these weights can significantly change the composition of the class that gets admitted. How these changes can be made is something that one can work backwards and figure out. And so we have a system that says, well, if only you were to twiddle these weights to increase the weight on this and reduce the weight on that, then this small change can actually result in greater of this kind of category of person being admitted, for instance. And these kinds of things apply to any time you're doing a set selection for employment or whatever. So that's an example of the kind of technical problems that one can solve and that we have an initiative to try to solve in support of trying to make our algorithmic decision-making and our computers act in ways that are more in consonance with our values and our ethics.
Well, a work in progress, and you're sending students out at least that have their minds thinking in terms of the idea of ethics and morality in computing and technology. Professor H.V. Jagadish is the Bernard A. Galler Collegiate Professor, Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at the University of Michigan. Thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you very much.
Among parents, there's a pretty common view. It's a real challenge to get those teens up and at them each morning. My next guest has some ideas as to just why that is. According to the National Sleep Foundation, teens need at least 8 to 9 hours of sleep to function at their best, but most kids don't get that. Julia Ammer believes teens are caught up in what she calls a sleep deprivation epidemic. She is a student at Community High School in Ann Arbor, and she's so concerned that she has founded a nonprofit group called Teens Need Sleep. I spoke with Julia at the beginning of her senior year. What has your sleep experience been during your high school years?
So in middle school, I'll take it all the way back then. In middle school, I found myself sleeping a lot more than my peers. And I was just a lot more rigid about my sleep habits. But I was still tired during the day, which was weird because my friends were not tired and they were sleeping a lot less than I was. So that actually led to a diagnosis of a sleep disorder, which made me even more aware about my sleep habits than I was before.
So you started, because of your own sleep issues, doing some research, and you start thinking about teens and sleep. So what led you to realize that teens are caught in what you call this sleep deprivation epidemic?
So it was kind of a combination of a bunch of different things, but the two biggest things were conversations with my peers where they revealed to me, I only sleep 5 hours a night. I stay up super duper late and then have to get up super early for school in the morning. I'm always exhausted, but I can just mask it by drinking tons of coffee and using energy drinks to mask my chronic state of exhaustion. So there was that piece of it. And then there was also the research piece of it. I looked into sleep deprivation among all age groups and realized that among teens, it's really, really serious. And I chose to focus sleep deprivation, like I said, is an issue among all age groups.
Yeah, we hear a lot of talk about people, all the side health effects from not getting enough sleep, but we don't hear it focused as much on teens, do we?
Yeah, you definitely don't hear it as focused on teens. And I really chose to focus on teens with my organization because as a teen, I know the power of peer-to-peer advice. And instead of having adults kind of throwing advice and suggestions on us all of the time, it can be really overwhelming. But I think if it comes from your peers, it's more genuine almost and can make you really think about your sleep habits in a way that maybe a conversation with an adult may not.
So why do you think that is, Julie, that kids in your class and people you know that are your age in high school, why are they not getting enough sleep? Why the 5 hours?
Yeah, so I think there are a ton of things contributing to the problem here, but one of the biggest is overbooking. And nowadays, it's just gotten crazy, the amount of activities and even just classes in school that teens try to take on. They feel the need to keep piling everything on, saying yes to everything. A lot of times, it's just because that's what their peers are doing. If everybody's doing it, I'm going to do that too. And so this overbooking, chronic overbooking, is leading teens to really not have enough time for everything in their lives. And what gets prioritized is not sleep. Sleep gets put aside and teens just think, oh, I can drink coffee, it will cover it up, or I can just deal with being tired, but I can't deal with not getting an A in this class, for example.
So whether it's studying, because I think when you hear people talk, it's often like a almost like a source of pride. I get by on 4 hours. I get by on 4.5 hours. What did your research lead you to discover about the long-term impacts of doing that?
Yeah. So sleep is crucial for our health, and there are a multitude of short-term effects that teens don't realize. I think the only real effect that I've heard teens talk about is, oh, I just feel tired. I feel groggy. It's hard to stay awake in class. But some of the long-term effects, sleep helps regulate your hormones. So long-term, you can have an imbalance of hormones. That's actually a short-term consequence as well. Your hunger can be thrown off. So sleep helps regulate two hormones called ghrelin and leptin, and they play a role in hunger and fullness cues. So long-term, inadequate sleep can put you at a higher risk for obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, stroke, other illnesses that are – or chronic illnesses that are related to behavior.
Things that someone who's 16 might not be thinking about, but when they're 50, that could matter enormously.
Definitely.
So what are some solutions that you have put together through Teens Need Sleep to kind of help kids do exactly that, get more sleep?
Yeah. So as hard as it can be, I think teens need to prioritize their activities and figure out what matters to them most and stick with that. Instead of trying to load on every single AP class or every single activity possible, I think they need to pick and really figure out how much time do I have in the day and what can I realistically fit in while leaving 8 to 10 hours, room for 8 to 10 hours of sleep per night, because that is what teens need.
And what if they say to you, but Julia, you know I've got so much homework in that class and the other class and my coach wants me at practice. What do you hope schools might do to help this cause?
Yeah, so I think schools need to make it aware to their students that sleep is just as important as healthy diet, exercise, and even schoolwork. Your health is just as important. And I think schools need to just make that more commonly known. And I also think two other things that schools can do to help are encourage students to challenge themselves, but not to the point where they're doing 6 and 7 hours of homework a night. And I know of a lot of schools that are encouraging that. They're encouraging students by developing ranking systems and kind of really rewarding students for taking on so much, where I think what they need to reward is students having a balanced, healthy life, and that includes getting enough sleep.
What about the times classes start?
Yeah. So the American Pediatric Association recommends that middle and high schools start no earlier than 8:30 in the morning. And most of the schools in this district and tons of schools across the country start way earlier than this. And the reason that schools need to start later is that teens actually have a delayed circadian rhythm, delayed biological clock, that makes them naturally want to go to bed late and get up late in the morning. So it is very, very hard for teens to start school at, say, 7:30 in the morning because their bodies aren't ready to wake up yet.
I have to ask about teens altering their behavior. And I'm holding up my smartphone, looking at this screen. And we've heard from sleep experts that we all need to put away the phones, put away the iPads, the computer, stay away from screens for a good period of time before we go to bed. Mm-hmm. And you and I know a lot of teens don't do that. In fact, people sleep with their phones. They wake up and text during the night. Mm-hmm. How do you even begin to change that behavior?
So I think it's all gradual. And if you try to just cold turkey get rid of your phone, it's not going to work. And I think the same thing is true for exercise. If you try to go in all right away to a hard exercise routine, it's not going to work. So it needs to be gradual. Maybe start by placing your phone across the room instead of right by your bedside. And then start by not going on it 10 minutes before bed. And then gradually increase that time so that you are not on your phone or near any electronics within at least 2 hours of bedtime.
Wean yourself off of that. Through Teens Need Sleep, what activities are you doing? Who's involved? And how are you getting this message out to schools around Michigan?
Yeah, so I have two advisors that are both sleep researchers at universities. And they are helping me just make sure that all of the information I'm providing is up to date, accurate, and really just the information that we want to be putting forth. So in addition to them, I have two middle school ambassadors, and these ambassadors are representing a younger age group, because I think I said this earlier that healthy sleep habits start early. If you can build healthy sleep habits in elementary school, in middle school, and then carry them with you into high school, that is the best way to go. So that's as far as my team goes. And we're really working on postering. I've created some posters because I think that just seeing something that reminds you the importance of sleep, or seeing a statistic, seeing something that sleep does for us, can remind you, hey, I should pay attention to my sleep habits and make sure I'm prioritizing my sleep. In addition to postering, I'm hosting information sessions for both parents and students at middle and high schools.
So I suspect that you would love to see this effort spread through schools.
Definitely.
Throughout the state of Michigan.
Yes.
Julia Ammer, founder of the nonprofit group Teens Need Sleep, on that campaign. Thanks so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Interested parents or schools can learn more by going to teensneedsleep.org. Coming up, the Lions picked up a win Sunday, but didn't turn too many heads while they did it.
Mediocrity is the biggest sin, and right now the Lions are nailing it.
That's in 15 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. All too often in this country, we only hear negative stories coming from North Africa. But a project developed by the William Davidson Institute at the University of Michigan aims to change that. This project created teams of students from the three U of M campuses plus Wayne State and Eastern Michigan University. And then they added students from Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and Morocco. Each team's mission to identify and address an issue in a North African community together, and then compete against other teams through a final pitch to an international panel of judges. Well, the final pitches happened last week at the Ross School of Business on the U of M campus. And this year's winning team is Echo MENA, with emphasis on MENA, Middle East, North Africa. Two of the eight members of this team are with us now. Jackie Spryshek is a sophomore at the University of Michigan studying business. Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you here. And we have Omar Abutaleb, who's an architect and a researcher who's based in Cairo. So good to have you here, Omar.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So briefly, what was the pitch, Jackie, that won the competition?
Yeah, so we found that there was a great problem of waste management in Cairo, and there's this population there known as the Zabalin community, and that literally translates to garbage people. And they formed in Cairo as an informal sector when there was a lack of jobs in northern Egypt. So they haven't unionized and they haven't organized because the government can't track their income, so they can't be taxed. So the Cairo government is outsourcing their waste management to Italy and France, who they use outdated, environmentally hurtful methods like landfills, incinerators. The Zabalin community actually recycles or repurposes pretty much everything that they collect. They actually are responsible for recycling 2/3 of the megacity's waste, which is incredible.
They're a big part of life in Cairo, aren't they, Omar?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, the Zabalin community are contributing in the cleanest and recycling of the waste of Cairo.
So what was the problem that you identified that needed solving through what you've come up with?
As Jackie said, they lack the legalization of the government. So we are fitting this gap and providing this solution by being the platform for this community to show off their skills, products, and what they are doing. Like, they need empowerment and so on for them.
So how did you solve the problem?
So what we created was an online website that was divided into three sections. On the first was a place where manufacturers could purchase raw products from the Zabalin community, like plastics, materials, anything like that. The second part was for finished goods that people in these communities are taking some of the garbage they collect and upcycling it into some really beautiful goods. Like, during the presentation, we had this necklace made out of recycled espresso cups. It was amazing. And the third part is a place for people in the community to put their stories. So if you are interested in the history or the path or the struggles of these people, you can go, and it kind of gives them a voice and a visibility that they never had before.
And you won with this.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, judges liked the idea and like having a necklace from them and showing them what they have, what they can do. They didn't expect that this necklace can be made of espresso cups. So,
so what did you win? Besides bragging,
we got a really big bag of goodies from Cherry Republic, which is one of my favorite places. Like this really cool goodie bag. We got a beautiful certificate. But I think the honestly, for me, the best part was getting the people to fly in and getting to meet the people from my team in real life.
Because this team, you've been working together how long, you know, across continents and oceans? How long has this taken to put this together?
Since May.
So I'm interested in, and here you are, you know, Jackie, you're here in Ann Arbor. Omar, you're in Cairo. Tell us what the process was. What did you have to do to be able to work as a team, you and your teammates?
Yeah, so at first we knew each other. And we settled on what communication channels we want to go on. Like we decided to go on WhatsApp and Google Hangouts. So we were connecting through these channels, like video conferencing and so on.
So you're looking at each other through screens and finally you meet. What was that like?
Oh my God, it was incredible. It was so amazing to kind of see like, yeah, you know, there are these people behind the text and behind the video screens, but then they become real. And it was so exciting for me.
If you just joined us, we're talking with two of the winners of the competition that linked students from Michigan to students and people who have issues to solve in Egypt, Libya, Morocco, and Tunisia, and talking to two of the winners of the Ekumena team. What did you learn about working with each other? I want to dig into that. Jackie, first of all, what did you learn about Egyptian culture in working with Omar?
Just, I guess it's not so different as we think it is, because everyone has kind of the same basic kindness and empathy that we connected with through each other. There are like some small differences in culture, like mannerisms and things like that. But overall, I realized how similar really we were.
What surprised you?
Not really a surprise, but I was really energized by just how motivated and brilliant and kind everyone is. So incredible. Just a great group of people.
And Omar, so you arrived in Michigan after all these months of working, looking at a computer screen. What did you learn about Americans and America by this process?
Yeah, people here are nice. They are welcoming for non-American people like me. So everyone was excited to know more about Cairo, where are you from, what the main differences between Cairo, and people were interested in knowing differences between Cairo and Michigan and so on.
Because, what did you think they are now that you've seen Michigan?
Oh, like, okay, I will tell you. Michigan is green. People stop like 3 meters away from you when you are crossing the street, which I like this.
Don't have that at home?
No, we are negotiation with cars in home. Like greenery, like snow, which is the most important thing I found here.
I don't need to tell either of you that we see so much polarization and Islamophobia in this country, in the U.S. right now in 2018. And there's a lot of anti-American sentiment that we hear about from around the world. So did all of this affect your preconceptions of each other coming into the project or how you approached the task?
Yeah, I think the most impactful thing for me was the language barrier. I have not had a lot of international contact from where I'm growing up. There's not a lot of people that come to this area. And I finally came to school and I had this opportunity to connect with people. And the thing I was most worried about was, what if they don't understand me? What if we can't communicate? And the thing was that somehow we made it work. We understand each other perfectly, which is beautiful for people that are using English as a second language.
Actually, like she said, we have language barrier a little bit, but we are at the end, we are human. We share empathy for this community. I want to tell you that Jackie is American. She started the presentation yesterday. She is talking about a community that she never seen, but she feels this community. This like fascinated me. She is talking about, she is an American, yeah? And this community is like a native community in Egypt that is closed, but like she know about it.
She could talk very well about it. Actually, I have to say, Jackie, as you describe this community of these people who've been underappreciated and undersupported, I watched your face, Omar. You were so happy as you watched her talk about this fact of life in Cairo.
Yeah, having these people dreams and like they want to equal rights, because as Jackie mentioned, they are called Zabbalin community, which is translated to garbage people. So they are missing a lot of their dignity and like rights as human. Jackie talking about them, like it made an empathy, like in the conference hall. People like were attached to the story. People felt what she's saying. People at the end, like attendees, felt the story behind this community. So I think there is no barriers between us. We are like humans. We feel each other.
And why is it important to build bridges like this between, you know, young people here in America and young people in the Middle East?
I think these bridges offer dialogue between us. Dialogue, when we talk to each other, every faces are falling off. When we start talking, like there is no faces. We are human. We can see each other. We can talk to each other. When we talk to each other, we like digging deep in this person, knowing that there's media carry wrong perceptions about each other.
So when you watch TV news reports, actually, or you see videos or things,
yeah,
it's not the truth.
Let me tell you something. Like we were like touring Detroit. People tend to tell me, don't go to Detroit. Like there is violence there and people, gangs and so on, guns, be safe and so on. Actually, we were in Detroit and one place that attracted me the most, which is the Eastern Market. As I said, no language barrier, but I have seen art, like this big canvas of walls made of messages of murals and graffiti telling that we are human, we have peace. I didn't see an English word. I have seen art talking about things we share, like peace, equality. These things like removed the perception I carried back home. I think like talking to people, as I said, changed, like has fallen these masks we had.
So in a sense, each of you will become ambassadors. And you're smiling as I say
that. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was just thinking what you said about the news and the media and telling stories. And I think when you see these really kind of hateful, twisted stories in the media, it's not telling a story about that culture. It's telling more of a story about our culture. Just in the sense that these things are built on fear rather than the empathy that we get from telling stories. And like Omar said, breaking down barriers, there's a barrier created when you go through certain channels in the media that are like if you hold a prism to the light and it reflects something different that comes into it.
So what would your advice be to someone, for example, considering studying abroad in the Middle East or taking part in like an international competition like this?
I would say, honestly, as much as you can experience of cultures, as much as you can challenge your expectations, I would say do it, because you'll never, I don't want to say like you'll never get anywhere, but you'll never get anywhere if you hold on to preconceptions that you've had without any experience.
And you get the final word on that, Omar. What would you say when you go back home and you are become this ambassador for what you've seen here in Michigan? What would you say to someone about trying what you've done?
I think in reality, when you experience the community, talk to people, it's another whole different experience. Like people can tell you some things, but when you are in a situation talking to people, you are deeply in the community, you can see the truth with yourself.
Changing attitudes one person at a time. Now, the final question, will your idea for supporting and helping the Zabbalin, this community in Cairo, will this happen? Are you going to be able to make it? You've got this idea. Would it be good to kind of see this become reality?
We have a visible plan. So with a little bit of support from government and like NGO institutions, I believe that we are ready to go.
Well, congratulations on all the work you've done and on your winning idea. Omar Abutaleb, who's an architect and a researcher who's based in Cairo, and Jackie Spryshek, who's a sophomore at the University of Michigan, studying business on the winning team in this year's competition with the Stevens Initiative. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Time to dig into the weekend sports results with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. So, what do you think about the fact we have a Lions win to talk about?
I am as shocked as you are. Look, and it shouldn't have been one, frankly. Cam Newton, one of the best quarterbacks in the game, is the leader for the Carolina Panthers. They're marching down the field there at the very end. They score a touchdown, so they're only 1 point down.
Yeah.
And a lot of coaches, 1 point down, of course, you just go for the extra point, which should be easy.
Right.
And then go to overtime or whatever.
But now, their field goal kicker had some problems, right?
That's right. He missed a field goal, which is not too uncommon, but he also missed an extra point, which is sacrilegious in the NFL. You do not do this. These are not college kids, not high school kids.
Right.
It's not happened at that level. So perhaps a vote of no confidence for him and a vote of confidence for Cam Newton, one of the best out there. They set up a two-point conversion. An option a coach has is to go for 2 points. This means all or nothing. You win or you lose on this play. And Cam Newton had the receiver wide open in the end zone, one of the best NFL quarterbacks, and blows the toss. Cindy, I'm telling you right now, you or I make that pass. So
he overthrew it and
he blew it.
Oh.
Amazing. And he was humble about it afterwards, but I'm telling you, don't get too high on the Lions, even at 4-6.
Okay.
Because they were given one.
And then didn't that also mess up the Lions' draft position by this win?
Yeah. I mean, it's like all the Detroit teams right now. You either want to win a lot or lose a lot. If you lose a lot, you get high draft picks, which means you get the next best player coming up out of high school or college or whatever. And mediocrity is the biggest sin, and right now the Lions are nailing it.
And it looks like they may have lost their star rookie running back, Kerryon Johnson. Oh, did everybody's heart drop when he got carted off?
Kerryon Johnson is one of the few bright lights in this team right now.
Left knee injury.
Ooh. These are never good in the NFL, of course. Getting carted off is not good. So if I had to guess right now, is that he's probably going to be gone for the season. And if that's the case, then so are the Lions.
Oh, boy. Over to college football. Here we have Michigan opens the week as 4-point favorites over Ohio State for this Saturday's big game. So based on what we saw from the Wolverines and the win over Indiana, what needs to be worked on before they meet the Buckeyes?
I would say a couple things. One is on defense, crossing patterns where receivers start in two ends and they crisscross over the middle. Those guys were wide open for Indiana. And the quarterback draw where the quarterback runs the ball himself, he also ran for a lot. They've got a good offense, though. And, of course, on offense for Michigan, it's the red zone offense, which means when you're close to the end zone, you got to score a touchdown, not a field goal. The good news, however, is they can kick field goals.
Yes, they can. Absolutely, because you have Michigan's freshman kicker, Jake Moody. I keep thinking, what his parents must think. Here their kid set a program record with 6 field goals. It's the most ever in a Big Ten game.
Consider this for a second.
Yeah.
This program has been around since 1879, 139 years, and the record had been 5 field goals to that point. No one's ever exceeded that. This kid.
Freshman.
A freshman in his first game ever kicks 6 field goals and breaks this 139-year-old record. I always love talking to Cindy about sports because you see it through a mom's perspective, and that is, oh, his parents must be so happy, and I'm sure they are.
I can't imagine.
Moody looks like he's your paper boy. He looks like about 14 years old, sweet kid, and cool as a cucumber, man.
So
the guy was legit.
Bright future ahead.
At least one more week.
So what does Michigan have to do to win next Sunday and punch their ticket to the first Big Ten title game?
Got
to
do what they're doing.
Okay.
Stay in your game. Don't get rattled. You're playing in one of the toughest places to play in college football, in the Horseshoe. You're going to get some bad calls because that's how this game always works out, as Mike Blank and I were talking about off the air, our producer here. Emotionally, Michigan's got the big advantage. Talent-wise, they're about the same. But Ohio State, no one on that team has ever lost to Michigan. They don't know what it's like. Whereas Michigan, man, they know that all their chips are in. They're playing for everything, including potentially a national title.
Yeah.
So the emotions will be very high. This team seems very focused. It'll be close, but I bet Michigan pulls it off.
All right, that's your prediction. And as for
And maybe based on a 19-year-old kicker.
There you go.
In his freshman year. So.
Wow. And as for Michigan State, what has happened to the Spartan offense? I mean, D'Antonio in his post-game news conference said the play calling was fine. Reading around, I think there are many who beg to differ.
Like everybody.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Including those inside the locker room. Look, at Michigan a year ago, they faced the same problem, an ineffective offense. Jim Harbaugh's offensive coordinator is Tim Drevno, a longtime friend. Their wives are friends. This is very difficult. And yet he made the tough decision to let Drevno go, change the offense, and it's worked out very well. That is what D'Antonio has to do now. It's a big boy business.
Make changes. And so what do you see for the Spartans after the Rutgers game this Saturday?
A mediocre bowl and then regroup for next year. And they will.
You have a lot of trust in D'Antonio as far as being able to make a lot out of little.
And no one does it better.
But you're saying it's time to make changes.
Look, whenever I said a bad year, he comes back with a good year. They're 3-9, 2 years ago, and they come back very strong last year. So he will again.
All right. Well, and then your prediction again for Saturday?
I'm going to go with 24-21 because the kid kicks the field goal.
All right, we'll see. All right, well, it's all down to Jake Moody, perhaps. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubakin. John, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.